Well, good evening.
Good evening.
So far, so good?
All is well, thank you.
Oh, so glad.
Me too.
There was a baby in a precarious getting born situation. Leslie was sitting with it tonight. Glad we had the sit. So there's a little bit of a chapter in number 25 that moves directly into 26, and so I'm going to try to talk about both of them. In 25, he says, our nature contains the 10,000 dharmas. In other words, we contain all of it. That seems ridiculous when you think about it. How can we possibly contain the universe or the galaxies spinning and planets spinning in the galaxies, and how can we contain all the mushrooms in the world and all the things that we can think of, the things. And yet, he says the 10,000 dharmas are our nature. To see humans and non-humans, both good and bad, good dharmas and bad dharmas, without rejecting them and without being corrupted by them, this is to be like space. This is what we mean by great. This is what maha means. Maha means great. Deluded people chant this with their mouths. The wise practice it with their minds. There are also deluded people who call having an empty mind and not thinking great. But that isn't how it works. The capacity of the mind is great, but if you don't use it, it's small. If you merely talk about emptiness with your mouth, don't practice with this practice, you're no disciple of mine. The emptiness of our nature contains the 10,000 realities we give names to, says Red Pine. And of course, that's our game. That's our fascination with the way our brain works. We want to name every little thing that we can identify. It's such a thrilling thing, really. And every language has that effort in it of finding different ways of saying, trying to reach that unspeakable place that we cannot really express. We can't even express book. We can say, book, this is a book. But this book appears in each of your minds, and it itself has its own history and its own beingness, you could say. And it's so complex, so awesomely complex, that we really can't possibly know everything about this book. It's not possible. We say, it's a book. But it's a live thing, you could say, in the world of us. We can't possess it, but we can identify it, which means we can point our finger to it. Identi means the dentum. Denti is the finger, points to it. It has an identity. But that just means we give it a name. Oh, this awesome mystery. That's a book. Okay. It's so interesting. So what it's pointing to is that if we take the 10,000 things for granted, and it's all just stuff, we're misunderstanding it. And if we start sorting it out as good stuff and bad stuff, we're also misunderstanding it. That emptiness itself is not empty like a vacuum. It's like space. And it's big enough to contain everything. Red Pine says, as far as Avalokiteshvara could see, no matter how we divide the mind, there is nothing but emptiness. This is the true nature of all dharmas, and thus it is the true nature of our mind which gives rise to all dharmas. And being the true nature of our mind, this emptiness has no limits. Thus it is great. But its greatness can only be realized in the exercise of our minds. Thus it can also be small. It all depends on us. My doctor asked me today what I did. It's a sort of new doctor, and I told him, and he said, "Oh, tell me more." Oh, really interesting. Oh, it's another one. He gets it. It's about empty space. It's not empty. It's full of everything. Red Pine says, talking about emptiness has always posed a problem for Mahayana Buddhists. It's the central concept of Mahayana, but it is also the most misunderstood concept. This was true in ancient India, where Mahayana pundits struggled to make clear the meaning of shunyata. And it was also true in China, where Zen masters struggled to do the same with kung. And it is now true in the West, where we continue to shipwreck on the shoals of emptiness. So, better not try.
If you call it a concept, you're bound to run aground.
You have run aground. Right? Every idea is another shoal. I like that. So Red Pine goes into this funny thing that I think is a little too much, but it's kind of we confer on the existence of something and separate it from reality. We confer on it a self-existent, that this book is altogether only itself, and it doesn't connect with anything else. We can throw it in the air, we can pound it on the ground, and it's just its own self. But of course that's not true. And emptiness describes the truth that it belongs to all everything. That there's no thing that is not connected to every other thing. We confer on it self-existence, which is a delusion. Its self-existence only exists in our minds. Its true nature is its oneness with reality. What emptiness does is to negate this negation. Emptiness means empty of self-existence, which is how Avalokiteshvara defines it in the Heart Sutra. So, if that's all emptiness means, a double negation, why don't Buddhists use a more positive word, one less given to a misconception? Actually, they do. For example, Chao Chu told his disciples, go have some tea. Buddhists have long realized that to attempt anything more would be to create a new set of problems, problems of attachment to some kind of oneness. Hence, about as close as they ever get to a substitute for emptiness is the expression not to, or non-duality. Of course, Weineng, this wasn't Weineng's way. He wasn't interested in conceptual games. So Weineng immediately goes on from emptiness to prajna. And I brought some words of Koban. I'll say what Weineng said first. What does prajna mean? Prajna means wisdom. At all times to keep your thoughts free of ignorance and always to practice wisdom. This is what we mean by the practice of prajna. One thought of ignorance and prajna stops. One thought of wisdom and prajna reappears. A person whose mind is full of ignorance says, I'm practicing prajna. But prajna has no form. It's the nature of wisdom. And what does paramita mean? This is Sanskrit. In our language, we say what leads to the other shore, which means what transcends birth and death. When we are attached to objects, we give rise to birth and death, like when waves form on water. This is what we mean by this shore. When we are free of objects, there is no birth or death, like when a river flows on forever. So we say this leads to the other shore. This is what we mean by paramita. Deluded people chant this with their mouths. The wise practice it with their minds. If delusions are present when you chant, because delusions are present, it doesn't really exist. But if you practice when you chant, then it really exists. Those who realize this teaching realize the teaching of prajna and practice the practice of prajna. Those who don't practice it are fools. But if they did practice, even for one moment, their Dharma body would be the same as a Buddha's. Good friends, affliction is enlightenment. One moment you're deluded and a fool. The next moment you're awake and a Buddha. When I first heard that, I almost fell over. It's in the Monday morning group, and he was discussing this, and it just, I thought, oh, maybe there's hope for us after all. It's not as bad as I thought. The Mahaprajna Paramita is the noblest, the highest, the ultimate. It isn't present, past, or future. And yet the Buddhas of past, present, and future are all coming from it and use this great wisdom to reach the other shore and to break through the afflictions and passions of the five skandhas. As the noblest, highest, and the ultimate, so you should praise this teaching. Those who practice it are certain to become Buddhas. But it's neither present nor past nor future. It's the same as meditation and wisdom, and it isn't affected by any Dharma. The Buddhas of the past, the present, and the future all come from it, and thereby transform the three poisons into morality, meditation, and wisdom. So, it's about thinking, prajna, and our thoughts lurch, it seems to me, from total ignorance and foolishness to deep wisdom. It's the way the mind works. And if we simply run on automatic, we lead a very unfocused life, you could say. But it doesn't mean that focusing on wisdom and practicing the prajna paramita and doing our very, very best doesn't mean that we're going to have a smooth road and do everything perfectly well, because we won't. We can't. It's not about that. It doesn't mean to get rid of thoughts, but just to keep noticing our thoughts, so that when we see how ignorant we are, we can free ourselves. We're the ones who are responsible for our mind. No one else knows what goes on inside. Thank goodness. Michael Newhall has done paintings of a big head, and then all these things coming out of it, and it's just all the various and sundry things that one thinks about. Some of them very beautiful and profound and lovely, and some of them just stupid and ridiculous, and some of them really bad. It's what happens. But what we do with what happens is what Buddha's teaching is about. It's described by the battle of with Mara, so-called battle. The battle of minds with your mind, in a way. And he was willing, Buddha, to sit down and just watch what was going on, and realized he didn't have to be carried away by it. He didn't even have to identify himself with it. It's just thinking. Coben said, it feels like we choose to think our thoughts, but it isn't so. To believe we choose our own thoughts is delusion. To believe they just come to us is enlightenment. When the sixth patriarch says water running forever, he means that even though it has waves and splashes, it is the same water always, flowing. In this way, delusions and passions are the same as wisdom. And he said about this side and the other side. This side we can make the other side. We can make the other side this side. We're always on the other shore. We think it's this shore. In other words, the other shore is supposed to be nirvana, this shore is supposed to be samsara, the world of afflictions and horrible mistakes and deep suffering. And the other shore is transcending. But of course, Buddha's whole experience was that it isn't about transcendence. It's about sitting in the middle of it and finding your nirvana right in the middle of samsara. Red Pine says, prajna doesn't mean to get rid of thoughts, just to keep thoughts free of ignorance. Is that asking so much? If we can just do that, then every thought becomes a thought of wisdom, a thought of things, a thought as no thought. Thus, in the practice of prajna, every affliction becomes a door to enlightenment. In fact, the nature of affliction and enlightenment are not different. But unless we practice prajna, affliction is affliction, and enlightenment is enlightenment, and the two are worlds apart. Depending on how we parse it, he says, paramita, Red Pine, says, paramita means perfection, or it means transcendent, which what leads to the other shore. This formless form of prajna is the perfection of wisdom, wisdom that transcends the realms of mundane objects and metaphysical dharmas. The realm of prajna paramita is pervaded by emptiness instead. Thus, prajna paramita is also viewed as a goddess, from whose womb of emptiness all enlightened beings come forth. This is because it is through the practice of this formless wisdom that Buddhas become Buddhas. Prajna not only gives birth to Buddhas, prajna is what Buddhas are made of. It's another name for our Buddha nature. So, there's time for questions, discussion. There are definitions here if you're interested in the five skandhas, the three poisons, etc.
Do you have a comment?
Yes.
I was reading again your son's book on trust in mind,
mm-hmm.
and he goes into shunyata or shunyata, however you say it, and according to him, shunya, or he got one of his sources, I guess is where he got this, shunya is zero. The mm-hmm. actual word zero, and there was a, I love this, there was a philosopher named Panini who came up with this concept of zero sometime, I think a little before the Buddha's time, or maybe right around then.
It was Greek, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, Panini, I don't think, it could be, yeah. Anyway, I don't know, that name sort of stuck with me. I think he was Indian, probably. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Indian? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyway, that... So shunya is actually, you know, a thing, and he described it as, you know, zero the way we think of it, but also when you have a huge number of things, you add a lot of zeros onto a number, so
to make more.
It kind of goes both ways.
Yes.
So, I guess the shunya ta is just a modifier like zeroness or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of helped me. And it, when I was listening to you talk about emptiness, it is much bigger the way you were describing it, but this little simple way is kind of a help to me too, to think of it, the aspects of zero as being nothing and everything, or unlimited kind of things.
Exactly. And without zero, people couldn't count very well.
Sure, yeah.
It was a marvelous invention.
Oh, that's true. You'd only have...
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
That's it.
And maybe ten
we
more.
We didn't even have the ten, right?
So you get tribes still in South America who only count to five. You know, and they don't feel any great need to know anymore. But philosophically speaking, zero is a powerful idea. Yeah. From which all our ability to begin to understand things in a new way comes. And it's the point where we begin and end. So.
Yeah. It's a zero.
It's a zero. Yes. Yeah.
The Maya independently discovered zero. Independently discovered zero.
The Mayans did, yes. And the Arabs had it and made it a lot of contribution to mathematics also.
They had a horrible time.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, thank you, Ellie.
Yeah, that's great.
That's wonderful.
So, if you're sitting here watching your thoughts go by, and you realize you're not your thoughts, but they're just coming and going, who are you?
Good question. Well, who's watching?
Exactly.
Yes.
Is there somebody watching?
Is there? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's the last holdout. Yeah. One more identity. Yeah. And yet you have to take responsibility for them at the same time. At least one thinks so in a civilized society. Though it looks like there's a lot of talk now about maybe that's old hat and we're not going to do that anymore. That we'll just let our thoughts come out as they are. And I've read several things and heard several things people talking about. Maybe this is our new paradigm. It's just to open our mouths and blurt. I don't think that's what Buddha meant. I'm pretty sure he didn't mean that. He was very careful about right speech. Speech, it can be the greatest kindness or the most terrible cruelty. It's the power of our words, of our identifying things. So next time, it's about practice. Practice, practice, practice.
Well, that's Volker, that's what we're going to discuss next time when you're not here.
Oh, alas, I won't be here. That's right. No. Enjoy. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going to Texas to be with some of my children and grandchildren. Just for 5 days for Thanksgiving.
Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, I hope you all do too. Yeah. Make it good. Whatever.
And Sunday, Carolyn, who we haven't seen for quite a while, at least I haven't, will be at Jikoji for the Dharma talk. She's going to be a teacher.
Yes.
I don't know the subject.
They don't announce that.
I see.
Yeah. Well, shall we have our 1 minute sit?